Welcome to this research seminar. It's actually the final research seminar of this academic year for the Paladin Observatory. But after Easter, in our summer term, we will be having other events, not least our biennial PhD symposium. Arete, can you remind me of the date of the PhD symposium?
26th of May.
I was right. On the 26th of May here at the LSE, we will have a full-day PhD symposium with PhD students from many different countries coming and presenting their research. PhD students in the early stages of their PhD, PhD students who have recently graduated and been awarded their PhD. And we'll have something like 65 PhD students presenting their current research, so that's great. But this evening, we are finishing on a high with a great panel discussion, which is the entitled Exploring Culture Wars in Greece, Mapping New Conflicts and Voter Support. I'm really pleased that we've been able to put this together, because it's based on two recent research projects supported by the Hellenic Observatory. Obviously, looking at culture wars, the theme of culture wars, from different angles. Let me introduce the speakers and the projects in the order that they'll be speaking to you. First of all is Rula Nezi, who is Senior Lecturer in Political Science at the University of Surrey. Her research examines developments in public opinion and political attitudes, and she's also interested in survey methodology and quantitative methods. She's published articles in many different journals, including the British Journal of Political Science, Party Politics, and the Electoral Studies. Now, Rula will be talking about a research project entitled Cultural Divides and Affective Polarization, and should be examining how cultural issue cleavages have realigned around new partisan identities. And I think she will also be putting it in a comparative perspective as well. Or she will in the Q&A in response to the chair's prompt. Secondly, we have the research project The Paradoxes and Mixed Record of Culture Wars in Contemporary Greece. Excuse me. And I think we have two speakers for this, Professor Sokratis Kongiorgos and Professor Dimitris Sotiropoulos. They'll be making the argument that in contemporary Greece, conflicts of this kind have started after initiatives taken by state authorities. In addition, participants in Greek culture wars have not been so much identity groups themselves, but political and administrative institutions, including ministries, the courts, and official church authorities. In Greece, culture wars have been interwoven with ongoing front-stage political party conflict rather than long-term simmering social tensions. So we have two different takes here. Sokratis Kongiorgos is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the Department of Political Science and International Affairs, University of the Peloponnese, and he's the principal investigator for the World Values Survey for Greece. Previously, he was Professor of Sociology at the University of Crete, and for short spells has been a visiting professor or a researcher at universities in Paris-Ouest, Nanterre, Paris-France, Milan, and Cyprus, Thessaloniki, and Aegean. He has taught and undertaken several pieces of research and published monographs and edited volumes in the areas of economic sociology, sociological theory, values, networks, artisans, small business work, and trust. Dimitris Sotiropoulos is Professor of Political Science at the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens. He is Senior Research Fellow of the Alibet Foundation, and more importantly, he is Research Associate of the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. He has also published numerous books and articles in international journals, as well as edited volumes on democratization and civil society, public administration and welfare state reform, with an emphasis on contemporary Greece, Southern Europe and the Balkans. He has led research teams and also taught and or conducted research in the United States, the UK, Spain, and France, and has had positions at Harvard, Princeton, Tufts, the LSE, Oxford, Sciences Po, and the Institute of Marsh in Madrid. So our two sets of speakers will report to us about their research projects for something like 15 or 20 minutes each. And then there should be plenty of time for us to have a discussion and Q&A. But to begin, let me welcome
Ruben. Shall I go first?
Apologies. it is Socrates who is going first. The clue is on the screen behind you. But, apologies. This is you.
Thank you very much for having us. And of course, the Lenin Observatory people, we also thankful to Eliam for trusting us back in Greece, and to our three research assistants, which helped us a lot with transcribing and keeping the tasks. Our topic is the paradoxes and mixed record of cultural wars in contemporary Greece, which of course raises the issue of what is a cultural war, or wars. The idea is that, the major social or political cleavages are no longer exhausted in the objective structural social divisions such as social class, gender, ethnicity, and so on. These, to be sure, are there, have their own bearing and impact. However, in addition to these objective, let's call them social divisions, there are cleavages at the socio-cultural level, and these entail and relate to a variety mix of values, attitudes at the symbolic level, including ethical, cultural codes, and lifestyles. Itself, the notion of cultural war was developed by James Hunter, an American sociologist. And in his mind, these were attempts to designate, determine, and shape the US public life. Comparable, of course, cultural wars have erupted in other countries in the West, the cultural West. Itself, the notion of cultural wars, obviously, the word war is an excess expression, a hyperbole. Intended to show that the warring parts, the two parts, are involved in the very divisive and profound disputes, and in this sense they have a warlike effect. Imprecise as it is, the term is caught up, and here we are with that. In the past, cultural wars developed, unfolded, when two broadly identified cultures that were antithetical to one another pursued each one their own sense of right and wrong and established opposite borders of moral communities. On the one hand, you would have the progressives and the other the orthodox. And this, of course, involved people being enmeshed in religious struggles or conflicts, and of course had to do with the shift between tradition and modernity, or laïcité. Now, in contradiction to this perspective, our own position is that, of course I've advocated, is that today's cultural wars are not merely linked to the alignment of older ethical codes and dividing lines that used to be based on religion and tradition, and that the shift is taking place. Today's cultural wars are related, this is our understanding, to the multiplication of individual and collective freedoms and to their maturing. Thus, for instance, this expressed above all in the enhanced possibility for expressing one's own views, for making choices, and authoring one's own biography, as Giddens would have it. Overall, there's a radical break and conflict that such developments bring about in relation to earlier established views. Now, we have addressed four issues, cultural wars. It's not the one, is it? yes, this plan. In our attempts to map scenery. The one has to do with the conflict between personal freedom, which is challenged by the state's requirement for vaccination against COVID-19. The other one has to do with the conflict between the challenges posed to the Greek national identity by migrants and refugees. Third one is conflict between traditional family versus modern forms of gender identity and partnership. And the fourth has to do with the Greek national identity in opposition to a European one. And the starting point was the rather recent agreement, Brussels agreement between Greece and North Macedonia. Now, to cope with this, we did the following four things. Firstly, we had a look at the minutes of relevant parliamentary debates. We had our plans of the Greek Parliament. The other thing that we did was that we had a look at opinion articles and reports from two national circulation Athens dailies, Kathimerini and Efemeridos Akton. The third one is that we went through, in particular, the selected academic literature on culture in today's Greece. And once these were done, we moved on to have four focus groups, each relating to the four topics that I mentioned earlier. And what we can say about these focus groups is that we had 5 to 9 persons, and they last up to 2 hours. I mean, we can move into details if need arises. I think that these are the data. Right, these are our methods, our approach, the way we collected data. Now, obviously, the second and the fourth cultural war that we identified relate to identity. So there is an issue of defining identity and, of course, defining national identity. And as is so often the case, or basically it's always the case in the social sciences, terms are contentious. They have different meanings. For our purposes, we should say that by identity we understand the ways that people's self-concepts are based on the membership in social groups. And obviously, social identities presume continuity in time and space and the capacity to keep a particular narrative going. Now, national identity is extended to include a definite language, sentiments, territory or political entity, and common symbolic features. These are elements that are interrelated, have functions, and generate a sense of fraternity. Overall, any given national identity is imputed with meaning for the groups and individuals alike, but adhere to it. Identity forms a significant, of course, collective identifier. Of course, any cultural difference does not necessarily lead to the formation of a social identity or social identities, but it has such a potential. Okay? Now, the I would like to say a few things about the social context or the context of the Greek cultural wars, and thereafter Dimitri will move into dissecting the our findings, what we've arrived at. Now, we soon realize that cultural wars, in the Greek case at least, are not just involve groups of people that make certain claims and find a position, and this is the context of the war. But in the Greek case, the ideological and political element is there at the very start. It's utterly politicized, and this creates a somewhat different situation from that encountered in other contexts of cultural wars. Two paradoxes are associated with this over-politicized perspective context of cultural wars. Thank you. We take a bit back. Right, here, in the end. The one has to do with the fact that, as we understand it, cultural wars in Greece did not appear from below, from industry parties and groups, but basically erupted once governmental elites attempted to introduce new legislation, new regulations on human rights, often to streamline and adapt national legislation to the European acquis. The other paradox was that the participants were not primarily groups of citizens rallying around the cause. These exist, but they were not the primary thing. But instead, they were political and administrative institutions which either initiated cultural change or fought against it. And examples abound. Just to refresh your memory, those of you that have a background, you could recall that the identity cards issue in the previous century, I'm talking about centuries, when the state, the Church of Greece is a state church, funded and everything, it's part of the state, rather than the civil society, opposed it in a very vociferous way. There are other many examples. Now, if we take something different, and this table, which might help to illustrate. This table portrays what has been termed by Engelhardt, Ronald Engelhardt, the post-materialist index. This is a four-item index. There's a simple version, a more complex one. This is the simple one. You have four questions, and depending on the type of questions and the responses obtained from representative samples, you can classify a country towards as being post-materialist, materialist, in between, and so on. We had two similar type of sampling take place. The one was in 2017, that's the World Value Survey 7. And the other one, the earlier one, was in 2008, the European Value Survey. They used the same questions, supposedly or not. They were identical. They were representative samples on which they drew their exams. And while the earlier sample, the one of 2008, indicated that Greeks were becoming, based on those responses received, more post-materialists, the later sample, probably reflecting the fact that there was a severe economic crisis, there was sort of a backsliding to more materialist positions. So in this sense, it would appear that the population in Greece was becoming less modern if the post-materialist aims and perspectives is the modern, or the more modern thing to do. This could be associated, this sort of finding, with the work by Stratoudaki, that she points out by dissecting a sample type of research service, that there is a heightening in the last 20 years of Greek national pride. And the other person is Ekelariou, who points out that basically the same period, those Greeks that normally declare themselves as believers dwindle, are reduced. There is, in a sense, secularization. So we have these two quasi-antithetical trends. Obviously, cultural wars take place in value-laden social contexts, and in this sense, following table might be of some use. It draws from the World Value Survey of 2017. And this is a basic question on trust, or generalized trust. Do you trust people? And, the response is, the statistics of the response are Soviet-like. I mean, need to be very careful, indicates that people are, you know, not trust 90.6%. Only 8.4% are more open. And then there's a set of questions which I will not elaborate, but will just indicate to you. This one, which asks respondents to say whether they trust their family members. And this is even more Soviet-like, because we have 91.5% the respondents say that they trust fully the family, and relatively so, an 8%. These are taken together usually to say trust and not trust, so we had 99.5% trust in the families. If I can have...
We need to...
Yes. I should say that in descending order, Greeks seem to trust, to be distrustful of non-family members, especially fit for the first time, versus other creeds and nationalities. And they trust their family members and their close friends. So I take it from here, and Dimitris to continue.
Thank you, Socrati. So this is a presentation of only slides of our research. Our research was indeed research that started out of a curiosity. Do the theories we have about Greek culture and cultural identity speak to the problems which are seen as contested issues in Greece today? We have theories which are very well known, such as the theory of Diamandouros about the westernized and the traditional identity of Greeks, and then other people who criticize him and say, no, we should talk about mixed identities. There is a whole array of other authors, and I will not mention them, and none of these authors really talk to the fact that today we have in Greece a culture which, as my co-author explained, is a mix of traditional views which, however, coexist with the implementation of new human rights, rights related to the democratization and secularization of Greek society. So we thought we should try to find not all types of people who subscribed to these different identities, but we should focus to those who we falsely believed would be adamant or fanatic about their views regarding the four issues that my colleague explained. So we approached for a focus group those who, in their eyes, in their own idea, they were very hesitant to accept that COVID vaccines were the solution to the pandemic. And then that means that we looked at the possibility of gathering together in a room people who they were very reluctant to accept the instructions of the government or the guidelines of the scientific community. And to our surprise, we found that while there were some views, which you can read here, that reflected this reluctance and skepticism to accept vaccinations and the other types of medical instructions offered by both the government and scientific authorities, at the same time, our interlocutors in the focus group were much more pragmatist. They were toned down in what the views they expressed and in their behavior. So while at the top of this slide you see the usual narrative of disputing the government and scientific instructions, then you see that as you go down the same slide, you read these views that were expressed in this first focus. People were ready to accept that lockdowns may have not been necessary, but they themselves were putting on a mask, and in fact, a few of them, as Socrates remembers, had also been vaccinated. And that was because they felt that the economic cost of not being vaccinated was really high. You had to buy from pharmacies, you have to buy tests, and then that would become a requirement for every single week if you wanted to go to your work. So there is a mixed record. There is mistrust. But then there is pragmatism, which is a theme repeated in our second focus group. There we gathered people again who voiced the more traditional views. And we thought that this would lash out against migrants and refugees. Well, indeed, there were some opinions like the first one that is an opinion you hear from people who are very conservative in the views with regard to the influx of migrants and refugees. But there were differentiations on these views. So we had people who said, well, not all Muslims, but only those who are more politicized, the radical Islamists, are those who should be taken care of by Greek authorities. Only towards that group, tolerance should be limited. And
you put Muslims and particularly radical Islamists,
radical
would be difficult to integrate in Greek society. Mm-hmm. So I read that as meaning that there's a sense that Muslims as a whole would be difficult to integrate in
Muslims as a whole, and also African migrants and refugees coming from cultures not so much of the northern Africa but of the sub-Saharan Africa, were understood by focus groups, group participants are being more difficult to absorb. However, then the discussion really changed around, and there was a series of statements like this. Immigration, is a real situation. It cannot be treated ideologically. Realism is the only way to approach it. The issue should be looked by, should be addressed by looking only at its practical side. Mind you, every summer, as you know, there is a dearth of hands in the Greek rural sector. There are not enough people to help with, the Greek
harvest,
and also to work on the land. So again, I would not like to expand on this, but please see that there is a second instance of this mixed record. The cultures of migrants and refugees may be incompatible with the Greek culture, but pragmatism should prevail with regard to what the Greek labor market and the Greek state should do about this recurrent influx of migrants and refugees. A third instance of the same theme is our group, a focus group of people whom we invited because we thought that they were very traditionalist regarding family and gender roles. Indeed, there was a differentiation here. So first, we had a discussion on the roles in the family, and we have this traditional view that functions that the woman has and the man has are different from the very creation. We should refrain from nullifying nature, as one of the participants said. And then we move to more sensitive issues. Would you accept same-sex couples? They were hesitant on this, but they said this is something that we see now in Greece today, particularly in the cities. And that is something that the Greek law should respond to, a situation in which rights should be secured. And then we move to the issue of having children. What is the view of their focus participants regarding single-parent families, and the second case, homosexuals having children? And then there was a restraint. There was less of, a preparedness to accept that a single-parent family is something that should be, diffused. And there was even less acceptance of the possibility that homosexual couples could have children. So in terms of parenting and how children grow up, if one of the two parents is gone, there is a piece that is missing. So again, we have mixed record, but I think this is the focus group in which the more traditional views prevail. The final one, the nationalists. We thought people whom we had invited, because we had first checked that they were very, very, let's say, traditional in the views about national identity and the resolution of the dispute between Greece and North Macedonia, that they would defend very traditional views. That was not the case. People, first of all, when discussing the relation between Greece and Europe, leaning on the side of skeptics, they were Euroscepticists, of course. Euroskeptics is the word. On the other hand, they accepted that nationalism is something that unites Greeks, and this is an identity that is, of course, very much diffused today in Greece, but it may have obtained a bad name. Why? Because of the rise of the Golden Dawn Party. So nationalism is something one is not so proud of. And then we moved to discussion of the Prespes Agreement of 2018, and we found out that despite the heated debates in 2018-2019, now people do not fear so much that Greek national identity is at risk. Again, we have a mixed record despite the long national legacy. The Macedonian question is probably closed. Would that be something that stays in this room, please? Thank you. And then, as Socrates said, we also had some research, did some research on the positions of parties, and it is not very easy to find a pattern. As you would imagine, on many occasions, the opposition parties would jump on the opportunity to oppose the government regardless of the intrinsic value of any bill of law that was submitted to the parliament. But on other cases, it was not, let's say, a distinction between, a contrast between government and opposition, it was a matter of ideology. So take the first example, granting rights to foreign migrants and their dependents. Here you have an ideological cleavage, parties of the right voted against, by contrast, parties of the center and the left took the other position. On the issue of the Prespes Agreement, you have a difficult situation exactly because members of the government coalition, the right-wing party ANEL, as you remember, did not want to vote for the Prespes Agreement. And at the same time, you have the interesting phenomenon of the opposition, including right-wing and left-wing opposition voting against the Prespes Agreement for very different reasons. The New Democracy thought that, at the time, that the Prespes Agreement was not sufficient and it may be dangerous for Greece's interests, and the Communist Party thought that it was an American plot. So, to sum up, the state, not social actors, are protagonists of culture wars. Here are examples. The identities issue, the identity cards issued by the Greek police, the intervention of the Council of the State in 2010 regarding the government's decision to grant rights to foreign migrants, that was struck down by the Council of the State. In 2017, another culture war started because of the government's decision to grant the right of self-determination of gender identity. Here you see, look at the opposition to this initiative, the Church, the Golden Dawn, and the Communist Party. Conclusions, we have a mix of materialist and post-materialist values. There is a mixed record, progressives on one count maybe traditionalists on other counts. Greeks take sides on cultural issues. They do not necessarily engage in conflict. We do not see what theory would have expected, that we have consolidated morality groups in conflict. Cultural disputes at the same time become part of the political arena, and that is what I mentioned at the very prior slide. The political party's stance may depend on its ideological profile or on its status, government or opposition. So culture wars in Greece are often started or waged not so much by social actors but by state institutions. And of course you would say that the same happens in the United States and in France, in other countries too, but we thought we should bring this up. People involved in cultural disputes are pragmatists. We put this forward to you as a possible hypothesis to be tested in other research, and there are no consolidated culture camps. So for further research, I think it is important to see why we have tensions rather than wars, and whether this finding tensions rather than wars is the result of the endurance of the left versus right, ideological cleavage, the democratization and spread of democratic culture, and the secularization of Greek society. Thank you for your attention.
Nice way to start my presentation. Because I keep my notes here. You mentioned that it seems like ideology is part of the culture wars or tensions, right? And it seems that it's mapped by political countries, to some extent. Actually, what I'm going to do now, I'm going to show you what are the implications of it. So I start with a famous quote from Lipset, just only to say to you that all these conflicts, they do have important implications, and especially for our democracy. And I think we can see that, we witness this those days. If you take into account what happened with Trump, like yesterday, we see that in the States, and I think in a certain way we also see that in Greece. So what I'm going to talk to you about is a fact polarization. So apparently it seems like Greece is not only one of the most polarized societies at the moment, it's one of the most effectively polarized societies. The definition is quite simple. Obviously, it's a theory that comes from the States, as it was the case with culture wars. The definition is quite simple. It's this tendency of people identifying with different groups, like they feel Republicans or they feel like Democrats. But what happens is that they feel very strong for this outgroup. Okay, that is kind of the definition of it, but let me try and explain it to you what I want you to feel. Affects polarization, because I think in our everyday lives, we all here have examples of affects polarization. So Kevin, can you think that time, like back in 2016, before the referendum, when around this nice kind of table at Christmas time, you start talking a bit about politics and you had all these friends and family around you haven't seen for a while, and while eating and drinking and these lovely things that I've been introducing in the UK, these pigs and British rabbits. Very good. Well, you start talking about like politics and the referendum, and they were fine that you have this lovely aunt that apparently was supporting you. And we've obviously seen for a long time and start talking about like the UK leaving the EU. And you were like, most probably, sorry, I'm using you as an example here, saying like, oh my god, this is a different world. What am I doing here? Do I really want to see that person again? Or when we're in Greece, for example, these nice endless summers. Right, and the sun before the referendum. And well, people, like younger people, were like at this nice kind of island, and you met this nice girl and boy. And you were somehow like supporting, maybe let's say, the memorandum of understanding, but in a sense, like we need some new policies. Memorandum is not the best thing, you know, but might help the country. And then you met this nice girl or boy, and they apparently seem like they're very strong supporters of Syriza, and they see like completely different view of the world than you do. And apparently you were like, oh, okay, it was nice, but maybe, you know, we don't see her again in Athens, or him.
I guess they're both cases in which a referendum created binary identities.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I ask something? Because the effect polarization refers to sort of, you know, the cultural element that she was referring. Because of course, you know, you had in the 70s, if a proletariat met a very good looking male or female bourgeois, they wouldn't necessarily, you know, they would still
exactly.
be polarized.
Yeah, thank you, because that's our claim, actually, that's what we say, but it's not. So apparently with effective polarization, what it's doing is it divides the society in a similar us versus them kind of idea, like populism does. But the main difference here is that effective polarization creates very strong negative feelings of animosity. So that's why it has strong implications. It's intergroup conflicts, basically. It has very strong...
So you mean both the material and organizational?
Yes. So it has very strong implications and non-political... It has a non-political dimension. So it wasn't a coincidence that I talked a bit about flirting and romantic relationships. It does have an impact on that. It has an impact on, like, the job market, We know that from studies in the States, obviously. It has an impact on how we see our friends and family as well. But it seems like in the Europe, affective conversation really started looking at it in Europe. Like I think the first study that was published was 2021. Okay, so we don't really know much about the origins and the implications of affective polarization in Europe. So all these studies I'm not talking about are coming from the States. But it has also political implications. But what we're trying to understand in this project is what is causing affective polarization in Greece and in a comparative perspective, like in other countries as well. And what we are saying is that actually is this new emerging tensions around country borders that are causing affective polarization. Right, so, but what I want you to remember from it is like, affective polarization is about intergroup conflicts, okay? And the classic theory from Tuffle and everybody back in the early 80s, people could create groups, like social groups, on the basis of some characteristics, and in this case, our common characteristic is partisanship. So what we did was that we tried to measure affective polarization in many different ways. So this is affecting, what is the situation in Europe today? We have data from this is the only data actually we have, but now we have a new survey in Greece because of the Hellenic Observatory. So this is from the Comparative Electoral Studies project. So what is the situation? You see Greece is here, so tensions are rising, right? You have some countries who are now moving towards the opposite direction, they're depolarized somehow, and this is Germany.
So the distance between the
revenues. Yes, so yeah, I should have said that. So this is like the distance that how affective polarization is moving, kind of says, it's across time, right? So you have Turkey, for example, constantly highly polarized society. You have Spain, they are somewhere in the middle, that is up here. You have, the trend is the following. Germany is an exception, they are depolarizing across time. To put it this way, and you have high levels of polarization in Eastern European countries, as you're expecting, and some Southern European countries, with Greece being like the most kind of polarized, affectively polarized society. And you have some countries like Albania, for example, where it's quite high, but it's constantly high. That's really
good. So when we only say red dot, is the data for the green dot here were not available?
No, this is like the movement. So this is so this is basically. Let me remember when it started. I think I have it here. So the red dot is the first point in time when we have data available.
The green dot.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the red dots.
Okay. So for Albania, do you have data for both periods?
Yes, I do. So they overlap. We can't see because they overlap the green and the the total. Yeah, so maybe it's not, for me, from here, where I start.
I mean, you know the data.
I know the data, but also from, I can see from here, okay. Yeah, so how explain that a bit?
I'm rather surprised that the two Scandinavian countries, Sweden and Denmark, I would have thought would have been more
young.
And what are the years?
There is a bit of a variation, so there is like the beginning of the, depends on when we have data. For some of them, we have the like 1990s. So these are election studies, right? And the most recent one is the wave, I can't remember, like 2016 onwards.
But across the various countries, then the most recent data there is just within a small number.
Yeah, like 2 or 3 years. It depends on when they had elections, the most recent elections. But I have more interesting stuff to show you. Okay, so I mean, I have described that already. So we know a lot about what is happening in the States. We don't know much about what is happening in Southern Europe, but we know they're very kind of highly effectively polarized. So now, because of our project and because of the Hellenic Observatory, we managed to gather some data from like it was like 2022 and measure recent trends of effective polarization in Greece, but also to develop like new measures that we think they are better at explaining social polarization. So the measure here, what they're doing is that they're asking people how much they like or they dislike political parties. But affective polarization is like, we're talking about interpersonal relationships, we're talking about the society, so it's kind of social polarization. Huh? So what we did is the following. I'm going to start. This is our survey, okay? The Helen Observatory survey here. So what you can see is that effect polarization, the measuring the traditional way, is rising. It's really high. It's quite interesting to see that in 2012, you know, it seems like the society is not very polarized. We think that this is basically a statistical artifact because the whole system collapsed. So when you have like a measure that is based on our identity and partisanship, and there's no, your party doesn't exist anymore, obviously, you know, effect polarization is going down. But it seems, I think, that the trend is quite obvious. I mean, it is rising, and it's getting more and more intense. So what we did was also, we wanted to find, because this is like a group identity, we develop, as I said, new measures. And what I have here is, this is a classic example of questions that are asking people about their identity. Okay, I feel that we are part, I belong to this group, I'm part of this group. I feel like I get offended when they talk bad about my group, right? I feel, for example, that I have a lot of in common. I share a lot of common with my group, you know, with the other Greeks, for example. But here, the question is, how do you feel when they talk, or do you think that we have a lot in common with other voters from the New Democracy? Okay, or from Syriza? And these are the results. This is like an index. This is like an aggregated level of all the questions, these five items. When they talk about the New Democracy or the voters of New Democracy, I feel like I'm part of it. When they talk badly about them, I feel
so
like they're
in both cases, by far the largest group are the most negative of the other parties.
Yes, yes, exactly. So if you see effect polarization as a group identity, then this is what we get, right? So it seems like we're getting more and more polarized in Greece. But what is even more interesting is that they asked them, how do they feel, the supporters of Syriza, how do they feel about the supporters of New Democracy, right here. And what you get, so they asked them, do you think that they're closed-minded into their thinking? Do you think, the second one is that, do you think they're is foolish, basically? That is the question. Or do you think that they're dishonest? Can you trust them? Or do you think that they're extreme? Or the final one is like, do you think they're incompetent, right? I mean, these are Syriza towards New Democracy. Okay, this is how they feel for the voters of New Democracy. I mean, in general, they don't think that they're very open-minded, at least. Not necessarily very extreme, though, right?
What's the difference between the first two?
Yes, it's foolish. It's a bit like, it's foolish. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you think that they're foolish. Well, yeah, they don't have, you know, a very good view, kind of them. But definitely not extreme. Okay, so this is the case with what is happening from the voters of New Democracy. How do they see their outgroup, the supporters of Syriza? There are some similarities, okay, especially when it comes to whether we can trust them, whether they're honest or not. Okay, so the both groups, they say, okay, maybe I cannot judge them on the basis of the partisanship or the party they support. Definitely, you know, they think they're not, you know, they think they're a bit foolish, they're not very kind of open-minded, not very competent kind of either. Okay, so that they see the two groups in a completely kind of different way. They're very distinct measures here. Now, this is part of a very interesting question. Typically, we're asking this question when we want to understand anti-immigration attitudes. So we ask them, do you want to live next to a gay couple? Or someone who's an immigrant, like from Africa, or someone who has two dogs, for example, or next to someone who is a supporter of Syriza, or someone who's a supporter of New Democracy. I can tell you that on average, it was something like 12 to 30% of our sample who said, I don't want to be living next to someone who voted for Syriza, or I don't want to be like a neighbor with someone who voted for New Democracy. It was like a no.
So they'd rather live next to a very loud, aggressive dog.
Apparently. Seems like it. Seems like it. But here we have split the sample. So this is not the whole population. These are kind of, let's say, partisans. So people who are very confident that they are going to vote for New Democracy or for Syriza, and people who voted in the previous elections for Syriza and for New Democracy.
and zero.
So it's a yes, no. So yes means I don't mind.
I don't mind.
Yeah.
Okay. One means I might.
Exactly. So this is this. I mean, here it didn't make a difference. They fall into this kind of 10%, category.
Yeah.
But I think this here is quite interesting what is happening, because this is what is happening when you ask the supporters of Syriza whether they would like to have as a neighbor someone who voted for you to ask it. And they're split.
So was the question on a two scale, yes, no, or had all sides? Because the
it was a yes, no, no. So this
not up to 100%. So.
So no, it has. I know what you mean. The question was basically asking, giving them multiple categories and asking them yes, no, yes. It was like which one for which one of those you're not going to have a neighbor, and out of this one we constructed this this graph.
What I'm saying is that if you take the left graph and you sum it up to 100%, then this is not 50 over 10, it is whatever, 70 over 10.
Yeah, but if you have a percentage of people who didn't answer the question. That's what.
Do you have, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just asking, do you have the article to show where the example Syriza voters would be more willing to live next to immigrants?
Yeah, I do, but I'm not, yeah. We can send the data, with you. So yeah, we ask a lot of different questions, whether they want to live next to someone. So it was like Roma, obviously, people like gay couple, immigrants, different. I think we had immigrants like from Africa and Muslims. We had a family with dog, a single mother as well. Yeah, so we have like six different categories, including the one that's used in your democracy. So that was like our way of basically measuring, or different ways of measuring effect polarization. So for this project, what we're trying to do was trying to understand what are the origins, what are the causes of effect polarization. So we know there have been many studies saying that Greece is one of the most kind of effectively polarized societies. But that's all what we knew. So our goal here was based to try and basically develop a new theory and empirically test it in the case of Greece. So we knew that there was effect polarization, we measured it in very different ways, and it seems that there is. So what we were saying is that we know that it seems like, at least in Europe, this concept, this culture wars, kind of cultural tensions, they're on the rise, and we have kind of new issues, more cultural, more of these issues arising. So let's see whether all those kind of culture wars, cultural issues, they map into party partisanship, and whether what is happening is that they are causing, somehow causing effect polarization. So in our case, culture wars was the independent variable, right? An explanatory factor for effect polarization. So we know why this is important, and I think that both Socrates and Nietzsche is doing a great job at explaining like culture wars and effect polarization and the different kind of types of polarizations and around cultural issues that we observe in Greece. So I might have to. How much time is it left? I know that we're kind of short in terms of time. Just a few minutes. Okay. So basically, this is how it all started, okay? So we started thinking, for example, so why is it the case that we have a lot of voters for their far-right parties, for example, in Europe and even in Greece, that they tend to embrace kind of climate change, and why we see the same happening with the vaccine, okay? Or, for example, they oppose homosexual marriage. I think we have... I can skip this one, because what we say basically is that it's because of all these cultural issues that they tend to align with partisanship. So that is why we observe this phenomenon, and eventually we observe affect polarization. The obvious question, I think, what you might be having in mind is that you might see affect polarization around the issue of the memorandum. And we do have kind of evidence suggesting that it was the case back in 2015, that actually it wasn't so much about the cultural issues, but it was more about the economy or economic related issues. So just to give you a bit of a hint, it doesn't seem to be anymore. Obviously it does have an effect, but definitely it was in 2015. Just to say that in our survey, the same questions that we're asking about Syriza and new democracy, we're asking the same questions for those who supported the memorandum, those who were pro or against the memorandum, just in order to test whether people are forming, like citizens are forming groups around these pro or against the memorandum camps. Apparently, it seems that this wasn't the case anymore. And this is the same question that I, as the one about social affectualization as a social identity that is very relevant here. So whether they feel part or they feel that they form a group, okay? So we are one camp, we are the ones opposing the memorandum, and I can take pride out of this identity, right? Okay, so what do we do? Culture wars. We know that as a term, it was first developed in 1992 by Hunter. And typically, or those days, we think that when you talk about affectualization or cultural issues, we tend to talk about issues like abortion. Think about what is happening in Italy, for example, those days, right? So if you have a female, Italy is a very affectually polarized society as well. So you have a female candidate who says, like, I'm not going to ban abortion because I cannot do it on the basis of the Constitution, but I make it a bit more difficult, or I will be cutting spending on issues related to abortion, right? So that there is a general tendency, especially among populist far-right parties, talking about this very traditional view of the position of women and of the position of the family in general, right? So cultural wars, it seems, relate to abortion, gay rights, death penalty, and especially the role of women into society. We'll also say it has to do, might have to do with issues related to parents. And obviously with vaccinations, as you have also described. So what we did, we took like the data that we collected in 2022. We ran a couple of models that will allow us to, at the same time, let's say, to have an independent variable where we're trying to explain affect polarization and see what is the impact. And at the same time, to put it, they call it structural equation model, but what they're doing is, like, in simple terms, think about it as a factor analysis and a regression analysis kind of at the same time. So that will allow us to say whether all these variables that Dimitris and Socrates described and the ones that I just described as, you know, being part of culture wars, whether they actually form a group of variables measuring one dimension, right, like cultural dimension or an economic dimension, and then at the same time simultaneously to see whether they create these variables, whether they have an effect on affect polarization. So that's what we're trying to do. Okay, I'm almost done. Almost done. Okay, so a few things about our data. So we're presenting you here the classic measure of affect polarization, like, dislike. We have included as cultural issues LGBT-related issues, which I'm very happy to see that you've also found that in your focus groups. The environment, a lot of variables regarding immigration, a lot of variables related to the position of women in the society, so women should stay at home, women should not be working, all these classical variables. Attitudes about the economy and the memorandum, and ideology as a catch-all term, that has to do with, like, whether people stand on the left, right, where they locate themselves in the left, right dimension. So it looks as simple as that. Okay, but I'm going to explain to you what is it here. So all these little squares, they are different variables. All these variables that Dimitris and Socrates actually were mentioned, all these dimensions that you find. So we see that together, they create one group of variables that is called cultural, okay? So they do create a cultural dimension. We have another type of variable that is measuring whether the referendum, the position of the referendum, which we think is the starting point, or we think is an important point in time that basically create higher levels of polarization. We have a group of variables that we see that are measuring like economic-related issues, and they're here, and you can see that this is the only variable that is directly connected to ideology, because apparently from our study what we see is that these cultural issues, they're not part of the ideology, which I find very interesting. So we tested different models, right? So we see that the position of the economy is directly linked to the ideology, but not those cultural issues. And we say that all these three dimensions, they can explain affect polarization and the rise of
polarization. What's the bottom one?
Referendum, the position of the economy. Right. Okay, so obviously what we found is that it seems that these cultural issues, they do have an effect on the rise of affect polarization. So it's, at least, I mean, we're running multiple different tests at the moment, and we have the same models in the UK, Greece, we did it in a couple of Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, so we kind of bring together, or we merge data from the 1980s up until today, and we're running the same models for different countries. We have a bit of more complex picture of what is causing, or what are the origins of affect polarization, but it seems definitely that cultural issues, they do have a very strong effect. Now, the referendum is still divides, or the position they had, the Greek referendum, still divides the society. And as I said, it seems like also that the economy has an impact, but this is basically what we care about here, that these divisions around these cultural issues, it seems that they have a significant effect on affect polarization. We recently, and we'd like to thank the Hellen Conservatory for that, because we won a BA small grant to test the theory in Italy, and it has to do a lot with the work that we have already done for here at the Hellen Conservatory, so thank you a lot. And we're putting together a much bigger proposal. Just to say also that we have a massive questionnaire, and a lot of questions on affect polarization, cultural issues, a lot of survey experiments. So, if you have an interesting idea, if you would like to work in the Greek case, or you're interested in this kind of factorization or experiments or anything, just drop us an email. Okay, thank you.
Well, it's okay. Thank you to each of you. I thought it was a very interesting discussion. How on earth did we try to put the jigsaw together? Let me try to raise a couple of issues. I suppose the first question would be the same question to each of you, actually. I think Dimitris or Sokratis mentioned about the traditional Nikephoros Diamandouros notion of a cultural divide, the pro-reform traditionalists, pro-Western, the other last. Etc. It's a binary clash. And I was trying to think, if he was here, what would your research be telling him about the validity of that binary divide? I take it that there's a distinction between the cultural attitudes and support for political parties, okay? I take it that there were questions of causality, but what should we take away in terms of the cultural schism idea for Diamandouros from your research? And then perhaps some more particular questions. Of course, both Sokratis and Dimitris cheered us up that there are these lunatics who have very, very strong antagonistic views. But when we get them together as a focus group and talk to them, their attitudes become softer. To what extent is there a risk that that's a result of the methodology? The two professors, well-known professors in Greece, talk to a focus group and ask them questions about the robustness of their views. Is there a risk that they are giving you responses that, on reflection, they think you want to hear? Well, I was fascinated by this survey. It's academia. It's kind of street-level gossip up to academia. So I'm really fascinated to know, for example, whether a Syriza voter or an ND voter is far more willing to live next door to a single mum than someone who votes for the other political party. You're absolutely right with the parallel with Brexit. Colleagues here, Sarah Hoboth, have very much talked about the negative stereotyping of the other, group. I think Remainers had marginally more negative stereotypes of pro-Brexit people, but then that's probably objective and direct anyway. So I wonder, with your approach, you say to compare with other countries, don't we proceed with caution if we're finding very much the same results in very diverse societies?
True. Yeah.
Okay. So, in the first 2 minutes of responding to two very good sets of presentations, those are my first responses, but I hope to come back later. I don't know, for the first question, if we could just perhaps go this direction, starting with Dimitris and Socrates. What did we learn from your research to qualify the Nikolaos Diamandouros cultural divide notion?
Thank you for these comments and questions. Regarding the theory of Diamandouros, I think one could say the following. His research was primarily focused on political culture, not all kinds of culture, not on moral issues or issues related to family. And thus, we think that if Nikiforos Diamandouros was present, he would take away from our research that there is the possibility that people may belong to different political camps. However, that is not necessarily the case for their opinions on non-political issues. In that is one of our major findings, that you have people who have a mixed identity. So you could have very conservative voters who would be tolerant towards same-sex couples, and we suggested that this is something to be elaborated further on, since we just put forward some hypotheses. And that is, I think, what links your first comment to the second, that is whether the methodology has problems. Indeed, may I take this opportunity to talk about the limits of our work. And you still consider me a co-author? So the first limit obviously has to do with focus groups. Focus groups are not a research technique that allows anyone to draw a representative sample. Its function as a research technique, as you know, is totally different. The idea is to be able to trace nuances and shades of themes that come up in a discussion, rather than having a very concrete theme on which you don't elaborate, but you ask people to tick their attitudes, usually in a Likert scale. We don't do this in focus group. We try to dig up these underlying themes. And this, I think, was both a limitation and an advantage of our work. At the same time, we thought that if we had in the same focus group, in each one of the four focus groups, people who were completely different in terms of their lifestyle and value systems, we would have no results. The reason why we put together these focus groups by picking people who were converging towards traditionalist views was to allow them to feel that they were among friends. And we kept a very low key attitude. We said we are humble researchers, and we did not interfere in the discussion, but allowed these people who came from different walks of life to express themselves, feeling that they don't have to defend their most crystal clear, recognizable view, because there was no one there, for instance, in the group of anti-vaccinationists, who was a representative of the medical scientific community to explain to them that they were completely mistaken. We didn't invite such people in the group of anti-vaccinationists. And in the group where we talked about gender and family, Rose, we invited people of the church and traditional mothers and fathers, and there was no one who represented the LGBT community. And we think that thus we have at the same time, to finish my point, again, in this case, a limitation of our research. There was no, there were no opposing views in the same focus group, but also an advantage of our research, that these people could bring up their less fanatic views, and thus we could write down that there were shades of opinions among the traditionalists. There were other limitations which I will not mention because perhaps my name would be erased from my own.
Can I add
something?
Fine with the Diamandouros distinction, I mean, with what Dimitri said. Obviously, focus groups is a heuristic device, and this is how it operated. We asked some colleagues and friends to comment on our draft, and I think a couple of them pointed at the same point. The fact, for instance, that they were, with the exception of the first focus group, they were in an office, an AMEP office. They were offered tea. It was a civilized context. Mellowed them somehow. But they did express views. And what we wanted to see was how they placed themselves, how their ideas related to the topic. And in one sense or another, they did that. And in this sense, we got something. Definitely, it's not a representative sample, of any sort. Yes, what you point out, yes, I think that the context, the method itself, did affect, in a sense, at least the tone of what the respondents said.
Just to add something. On focus groups. I think they're doing, I mean, also an excellent work on trying to identify patterns. And there have been a lot of experiments on affect polarization where they're actually using focus groups where they're trying to see how can we reduce the level of affect polarization. And it seems that it's working, you know, when you're talking with others about their position, they, you know, they, it seems that they're trying to find kind of a common position or something. But I think this is not the point what focus groups are saying. I think it did an excellent job on identifying the different patterns by using the focus groups. And it definitely helped our research as well. Just to say that. Okay, so I can't remember the exact number. It's in my computer, and I can share it with you, the exact number of those who are supporting Syriza, who prefer to live next to a very loud and dog or not. But I think that it is an indicator of kind of this tension that we see those days. Also, I mean, in Greece. Just to say that in the a few things that about the survey, just to say that we have more questions included that I didn't present here when we're trying to understand how can we reduce the level of polarization. And one of the explanations that we're giving is this sense of national pride. So and so we have a lot of experiments also and a lot of questions trying to understand additional or to use additional theories on what is causing affect polarization, but also how we can somehow depolarize the system.
The relationship between national pride and the state of the economy?
National pride, yeah. So we play around with that. And we play a bit, we give different scenarios that make them feel very proud, and to Greeks, obviously. The Olympics, the 2004 Olympic Games, and how we handled the Greeks, the Olympic Games, the preparation.
I simply meant that it was a serious one that would feelings of national pride co-vary with a sense of economic well-being?
We can talk about that. So we have, I mean, obviously, I don't think that many people, so that is 2022, is after the crisis, right? But we do have questions about how do they feel about the economy, so we can talk about that. perceptions about the economy. But from the comparative perspective, just to say that we get similar but not exactly the same results. So it seems that there are differences. There are some countries where economic issues seem that they are causing tensions more than cultural ones. And it's not that all cultural issues play the same kind of role. It seems that in some countries, the issues that are important and are causing cultural wars and affect colonization are different. So in some countries will be women's rights and position in the society. In other countries could be issues related to the environment. So we have some mixed results, and we try kind of different ideas, trying to find some patterns there of what is causing what. So it's not, they're not exactly the same, but there is a general trend that cultural issues tend to have like an important role on affectorization.
Yeah. Okay, we've got several people on, so take them first, Vasily.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so I mean, the way I understand it very quickly, the main message I get from the two presentations is different. One is that, you know, the political affiliation does not play so much on the cultural, and even if it does, we're talking about cultural grievances, tensions, exactly as you had in the slide, Van Wars. The message I'm hearing from Rula is the opposite, is that, you know, culture and cultural issues become more prevalent, and they affect the intensity with which we, you know, affiliate with the party affiliation. So I wonder whether this is really, you know, the methodological issue behind it, because of course it's the same population. We did refer to the question about the focus groups. I think also, in a way, from what I understood, and I may have misunderstood it, in a way there's a bit too much forcing people into categories. So if you have a binary question, you know, do you like Syriza or do you hate Syriza? I mean, you know, approximately 50% of people would hate Syriza. But in reality, they may not hate Syriza, it's just that they do not like Syriza. Likewise, on the cultural issue, you know, are you pro-abortion or anti-abortion? I mean, the majority of people I know, they wouldn't be able to give a very, very straight answer to that. Yeah? There would be a qualified answer. You know, I'm against, but, or I'm in favor, but, you know. So, you know, are you forcing culture and the polarization to be too prevalent? In a way, the opposite of what the other studies may normalize. You know, in a discussion, if you talk over 5 hours about an issue, then people mellow. So is the difference maybe because of, you know, the approach that the teams go?
It's a brilliant question.
Yeah.
Would you mind if we try to group? Because I'm just conscious of time. Stella, and then Kira, and then Constant, and then...
Say, I admire you all for trying to even measure these cultural tension wars and us here criticizing your methodology, but I will do the same. I'm wondering now, being in a time that we have another war in Greece, political, cultural, I don't know, but I think we are in a very tense period. How important is the timing that you're conducting the research? And I'm not talking about years, I'm talking about the exact timing, and how could this change your results? So running this focus group, you know, before or after a very big event, or, you know, the surveys, how long do they run? And because all this has to do with emotions at the end of the day, yeah? People are expressing their emotions. They're not really expressing so much beliefs. That's what I understand here from what you're describing. Or they see their beliefs through their emotions in a way, and that's why they mellow or they go extreme. Because the self, the identity, has become so important in our societies, much more than the group. So this timing can be really mind-filling.
Thank you very much for the very interesting discussion. So I was wondering if, apart from the methodological issues that we have discussed, one of the takeaways of the discussion could be something that aligns also with experience, I think, personal experience, which is that, you know, if you go and say, hello, I voted for New Democracy or Syriza to a person who voted for the opposite, you know, they're going to have a culture shock generally these days in Greece, right? Whereas if you go and, you know, you don't say that and you start discussing about the subject matter at hand, vaccination, whatever, the economy, anything, you know, usually you can have a reasonable discussion, even if, you know, you voted for the opposite thing in the election, for most things, I think. And I think, you know, that probably generalizes also in other places. So for instance, I did some field work in an area that voted very highly for leave. And you know, once you start having a conversation about the future of the local economy and the mistakes of the past, and you don't talk about, you know, who was right and who was wrong in 2016, people are going to have a reasonable conversation with you. It's not, you know, it's possible. So I'm wondering if there is an element also of that in explaining the difference between the conclusions of the two studies. And I wonder what the implications of that are for people who care about fostering a better quality of democratic dialogue. So how can you, first of all, encourage this kind of, you know, finding common patterns on specific issues, even if you disagree on specific political choices? And how can you leverage that in order to, you know, create a degree of cohesion in the, you know, body of citizens, basically?
Thanks, first of all. It was very interesting today. I'll try to be brief. So what I'm finding myself sometimes skeptical of the sense of, if we focus on political parties, how people are voting to see how they view cultural things like abortion, immigration, things like that, I'm not sure if it makes really sense, because I feel that there is a transition between being progressive and being conservative. And I see that being conservative is a value being said among the left as well. So focusing only on the far right to say, you know, if you would do the vaccine, or if you support abortion or immigration, I'm not sure if any more makes any sense, because I could see the distinction between being progressive, and then among the left, I see people that are really conservative, and I see people that are progressive. And the same for the right-wing voters as well. So, I mean, this is a general question I have, and I think it's important in the sense of how we outline our research methodology and how we define, you know, the subjects we try to see how they behave and what they vote for, and then how they view society. Maybe we should rearrange it in a way as a sensitivity at this analysis, and from an empirical perspective.
Something on this point, that it's funny how, if you know that, you know, the Labour Party is split on the issue of X, and the Conservative Party is split on, you know, kind of cultural issues, why cultural issues would make your affiliation to any of those parties stronger, given that you find cross-party allegiances and alliances. The same goes.
Constantino, did you want to?
My question echoes Vasilis. You modulated when you presented yourself to the people. You didn't tell them, hello, I'm an emeritus professor from the sociology department of political sciences. You said, I'm a researcher. That's how you introduce yourself. Was your question, did you modulate your question, or did you say, I am exploring cultural wars in Greece? And did you say, I am exploring polarized societies? Did you use those terms? I assume you did not use those terms. And therefore, we are using very powerful words when chronicling the results, as you're doing here. So why would these words not be used to the subjects, but these words can be used within an academics circle?
Okay, great. The questions have made it even more interesting. And we don't have much time. You're volunteering to go first. That's fine. If you want to pick up on each of those points, and then we'll pass over to the other one.
So thank you all, because it's very, very interesting. And a very, very good points and very good questions that will really help us. Kind of methodological clarifications. So, obviously, even if you ask me, I'm not going to say, yeah, I'm a pro or anti-abortion like that, okay? So people, I mean, this is not how we ask the questions, right? So typically, there's a battery of questions asking people on what we call Likert scale, 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, to tell us whether they kind of agree or disagree with a sentence that we're giving to them, right? So women should stay at home, agree, disagree. So we have a lot of questions, and then we create an index out of which, and doing factor analysis and other, kind of using other techniques. So I would say it's not exactly like yes or no questions. So they have kind of a range of potential kind of, you know, values and potential answer they can give me. Now, just to clarify something about affect polarization. So affect polarization is not exactly, the way we measure it, affect polarization, is not like, do you support Syriza or you support New Democracy? It's a bit more than that. So we're asking people whether they like or they dislike a party on a 0 to 10 scale, and then there is an index based on the on how far they are from the median. We take into account how big and large the party is in the most recent elections. So it's a more kind of, it has been more nonsense, you know, as a concept than just say, I support Syriza or I do not support Syriza. So all graphs that I show you basically were kind of a simplified version of the questions that we've asked, just for me to make a point here. So the time of the elections, of course, it does play a big role. We don't have comparative, we don't have time series data, but that is one of the limitations of like surveys by default. But I think that, yes, it might have been the case that we conducted the questionnaire and the survey when it seemed like the Greek population was very polarized, but I mean, it's not that it's not right now, on the other hand, so it might play a role, but it's not that, you know, it seems that now, you know, people feel like a bit more, less kind of polarized. I don't know, have I answered all the questions? Kira, have I answered your question? Or,
it's okay, we can have a broader discussion later.
Okay.
She
doesn't buy
the
drink.
Oh, fantastic, okay. Just buy the drink and I sell the data with you.
Okay, so kind of
well, I can see that in terms of the time of the focus groups, well, it wasn't a particularly acute period. With the partial exception of the first one we had, which had to do with the COVID thing, it was about a year ago, yes. So it was still much more important as an issue. So timing does have a play a role, obviously. We need to discuss whose fault is that railway infrastructure in Greece are not operating properly nowadays. Okay. If properly, you will not be able to have a discussion. The others would like to.
Yeah, sure. Vasily, I also understood the same as I was listening to Rula, that our two different kinds of research points to different directions. And perhaps a solution for you to work on would be perhaps to, if I can dare something, say something about econometrics, work with interaction effects. So Rula had three sets of independent variables, stances on the economy, stances or attitudes on culture items, and political preferences. So in the model, if we just leave these three sets of independent variables and see whether they point to the dependent one, which is affective polarization, we may not have the whole picture. How about introducing interaction effects? Cultural answers to cultural items of the questionnaire interacting with answers to the economic issues. And then you have the model expanding, you know, more than I do about this, and it becomes a series of interaction effects, and then you see whether affective polarization is the result more of interaction effects or of the isolated independent variables. That would be a possibility. Stella unfortunately picked another methodological limitation to our work. I will find a penalty or a sanction for you later on. The major thing, however, which justifying me brought up is that if we had convened the same focus groups previously in the years before our research, which took place in 2022, we may have had people less willing to become, let's say, softer on their views. For example, 2017, a bill of law was introduced to the Greek Parliament about gender identity, and there was an uproar because the more conservative side said that people should not have, at the age of 17, the right to go to an authority and declare that they belong to a different gender from the one that they originally were assigned to. So 2017, perhaps that focus group would have worked otherwise. Kira, you are correct that people indeed engage in dialogue, but as I'm sure you know, research in the United States, where research on culture wars has flourished for many years, shows that one of the incredible results of affective polarization is that people stop talking to each other. So you have Republicans actually moving also to states or counties where other people of the same ideological profile live. They don't also exchange emails or have dinner with people from the other side. So, although I would suggest that you are right, that if we brought people from different camps together, there may have been a different result. Affective polarization is such an interesting topic, as Rula explained, because it shows that it can become very extreme. So instead of having dialogue, you have more distancing. And finally, I think Thodoris, and I'm sorry, I cannot remember your first name.
Constantine.
Constantine, sorry. Are right to mention that perhaps the way we understand these issues influences our interlocutors. The fact is that we didn't mention the words progressive or conservative or the term culture war. We kept those for ourselves. We think they are analytical concepts. And during research, if you introduce these concepts to the discussion, unfortunately, you don't get the correct results. In fact, you ask your subjects, if I can use this term, to give you their opinion of the analytical concept. So we pushed out the analytical concepts, and we just told them, you are very reluctant to accept vaccinations. Why? We didn't talk about camps, or culture wars, or anything of the sort.
Thank you very much indeed. That's a really good discussion to finish our series of seminars this academic year. So in the normal fashion, we would have an additional discussion, which is in the King George IV pub on Portugal Street. Do join us for drinks there. But before that, please thank each of our speakers. Thank you.